Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. New York State has been operating without a budget for over a week, and that means emergency spending bills had to be passed. It was just about a year ago when the Schoharie Creek Bridge collapsed, killing 10 travelers. And we'll take a look at the state's infrastructure developments since that disaster. A smoking ban may be instituted in New York State bars, restaurants, and public places. We'll have all these stories and more. It's all coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. New York State's fiscal year begins on April 1st. That means the state budget should be in place in order to pay its workers and operate its empire. But for the fourth consecutive year, state lawmakers have failed to pass a budget on time. Bruce Robertson has this report.
New York State lawmakers have not passed a budget on time since 1984. And when there is no budget in place, the state does not have the legal authority to spend money. That leads to many fiscal problems, including how to pay state workers. As a result of the holdup, lawmakers have had to pass emergency spending bills to pay its 94,000 state employees. The measures also provide money for the state to meet its Medicaid and unemployment insurance payments. Negotiations on Governor Cuomo's $44.2 billion budget proposal this year broke down mostly because of a dispute within the state Senate's Republican majority over the distribution of state aid. The Republicans wanted increased state aid to education and more money for solid waste cleanup on Long Island. But Governor Cuomo would not go above his $28.4 billion state spending cap. The conflict came down to how much money should be spent and where those funds should come from. Cuomo proposed taking the money from other parts of the budget, either from tuition assistance aid or out of member item allocations. Member items are those program costs each legislator gets for his or her district. But the Senate was not pleased with those options. The Senate and Assembly did agree to increase aid to New York's 736 school districts. Those schools will receive an additional $575 million in aid. This is up from Cuomo's proposed boost, but still well below the state education's proposal for $700 million in additional funds. The end result brings the total education package to $7.9 billion. Republicans also wanted financial assistance to remove asbestos from the schools. Cuomo proposed allocating $20 to $25 million more toward that end. The plan would not go into effect until the 1989-90 budget. The proposal was satisfactory for Senate Republicans, who have been holding up negotiations, but they still wanted more money. The Senate is calling for $33 million to remove asbestos from the schools. Budget negotiations have been going up and down as legislators are getting close to agreements and then further away. As it stands, Governor Cuomo has canceled two trips where he would have left the state and says he plans to stay in Albany until the issues and figures are ironed out and the budget is passed. Last year's fiscal budget was passed on April 11th. Reporting for the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
Ned Regan is the state controller and a man in charge of all the money in New York. He has a crucial bed of knowledge about how the slowing budget agreements have affected the state.
My concern is only that the total amount of the budget is a rational and reasonable number, that it is a number that we can borrow on, and is a number that allows us to go ahead with the borrowing and yet keeps fiscal stability and a balanced budget and the like. My concern is the total amount of the budget and the fact that it's delayed. I let the governor and the legislature divide up what they think is best. No, I wouldn't let them throw money away. I'd step in, but basically it's their call as to how taxpayers' money is spent on what state programs, and they have to run for office based on that. My job is to make sure they don't exceed the limits and that they don't unbalance the budget, and that hopefully they pass it on time so that we can get our checks cleared and our borrowing done. In other words, my job is to see that we have a fiscally stable state government.
Okay, what happens when they don't make the budget?
Well, then you start overtime. It erodes. You first of all delay payments for employees, which has been done. You skip writing checks. We are now at the point where our borrowing will be delayed 1 week. That means that the credit markets take notice. It's a reflection, small, but a reflection on our inability to come to grips with major important fiscal issues. It raises the cost of borrowing imperceptibly, but nonetheless it raises it. It delays payments to school districts of some $2 billion by a week. They have to go out and borrow money waiting for that, waiting for the checks to arrive. So it sets up, when there's a delay, a series of consequences and results, all of which, as the delay continues, all of which hurt only one group. The group that's always hurt when government misfires, and that's the taxpayers.
Now, Ned, in the past, we had a little trick here, and we used to print the paychecks, which were essentially IOUs, which the banks honored. You stepped in a couple of years ago and said,
We don't do that anymore. Absolutely not.
Because it just encourages them, right?
There's a legal ground for not doing it, because you shouldn't write checks where there is no where there is no authorization. So legally,
to say nothing of no money.
Right. Legally, I don't think we have a right to do it, but clearly, in terms of the policy and the politics, Alan, you're completely correct. If we make it easy for the government and the legislature to drift along here, they might take advantage of it. So the law says no, and clearly policy says no. My job is to continue to focus on the deadline, to continue to put whatever fiscal pressure we can on them to come to grips with this and let the world know that we've got the ability to make decisions and make them in reasonable amount of time.
Well, on that, we can all agree that the process is breaking down and failing, right?
No question.
Okay, now let me move on. You said, you used the word borrowing, going out and doing our borrowing.
Right.
Now, one of the things that you've been trying to do over the years, if I remember correctly, along with the governor, is to eliminate the need for what we call spring borrowing, which we pay a lot of interest on.
That's right.
Now, how's that coming?
Very well. It's the borrowing, this annual awful borrowing. I love the word spring. It's a politician's word to make it seem okay. In fact, it's awful. This borrowing, had we not stepped in very forcefully a couple of years ago, would have been $6 billion today. And yet it's going to be between 2.5 and 3 billion. So it's essentially cut in half from where it would have been.
Okay, Ned, how did we do that?
Well, we did it by my changing the, first of all, we changed the books so that we started to record things so that when the governor and legislatures were rolling over liabilities from 1 year to the next, and me having to borrow in between, that act of shuffling was recorded because we changed the way we shifted the bookkeeping process and the budgeting process. Then following that, I got the governor to step in and very strongly, and which he did, and the legislature at that point followed to say, let's stop this nonsense. If we're going to spend today, we'll tax today rather than spend today and tax tomorrow after the election, which was the process in New York before. So with that decision made, then the rollovers stopped, and at that point we were able to roll back, and we were able to start to reduce the borrowing. It's still the largest of any state. It still is reflective of the sins of 10 and 20 years ago. It still accommodates, to some extent, this process of kidding taxpayers, spend today and tax tomorrow. But nonetheless, the process is cured. It's a long way. It's gone a long way to be cured, and we'll have to continue till we get the borrowing right down to nothing.
Well, how soon can we expect that to happen?
Well, that would be years and years. As a percentage, of course, of the budget, Alan.
It's lower.
It declines as your budget grows 7% each year, and even if the borrowing stayed the same, it becomes a smaller and smaller part of your operating budget, and at some point it will be a normal kind of cash flow borrowing.
Well, on a $40 billion budget, why is it naive of me to think that we couldn't really just take one giant gulp and eat that in a couple of years?
Because the budget, the $40 billion, is a lot of it is federal money. And second, so you're down now to, let's say, $2 billion out of a $28 billion budget. That's a rather hefty one-time tax increase or one-time cut in expenditure.
As we mortgage owners say sometimes, although I got to admit I don't have one, but I remember when I used to, at what point do we start paying on the capital as well as the interest?
Well, we've been doing that for a long time, but the process is changing. You see, I'm not as concerned about the numbers as I am about political behavior. The important thing we changed was political behavior. If a legislator or governor now wants to initiate a new program, we now make sure that the taxing for that program is in the same budget in the year which the governor or the legislature gets credit for initiating it. That's called accountability. That's called democracy. So we now have imposed that discipline on state government that wasn't imposed for a 20-year period. That's the important thing. I think that in a state as large as ours, in a budget as large as ours, even the $2.5 billion borrowing we can accommodate. The lower it gets, the better. But the important thing is that the political chicanery that produced that borrowing has stopped, and that's the good news for the taxpayer.
New York State Comptroller Ned Regan. Just two decades ago, Reverend Martin Luther King was assassinated. Although the great civil rights and human rights leader died on that day in 1968, his teachings and spirit lives on. Brenda McMahon reports on some people who have followed King's nonviolent teachings.
In a recent ceremony, New York Governor Mario Cuomo praised the work of five New Yorkers for their distinguished civil and human rights over the years. Among those who received the 1988 New York State Martin Luther King Medal of Freedom were religious leader Dr. Israel Mauschwitz, activist Dr. Josephine Nievitz, and human rights advocate Erlene Patrice. Posthumous awards were given to musician Harry Chapin and author James Baldwin. Accepting the award for Baldwin was his sister, Gloria Baldwin Smart. Smart recited a quote from Baldwin's work, Evidence of Things Not Seen, and she thanked the governor for the award.
Governor Cuomo, honored guests, friends, on behalf of my mother, Mrs. Bertis Baldwin, and my entire family. My heart stammers a bit, but we solemnly and humbly and lovingly accept this award given posthumously to our beloved brother James. Thank you, Governor Cuomo.
Musician Harry Chapin received the award for his songs of injustice, poverty, and the plight of the underclass. Accepting the medal was his wife, Sandy Chapin. Chapin shared the words of her husband with the audience and his idea of reinventing America.
He said, "We have to reinvent America and go back to the basic principles of democracy, human rights, and human needs." He resented being called a radical and said, "I believe in the Constitution of the United States." We've lost our way when we've distorted the values in our society so that radical is someone who believes that a small farmer cannot have the right to work his land, but should have it turned over to a corporate owner who's going to take it out of production.
But perhaps the most stunning recipient was Erline Patrice. Patrice worked in the South when blacks could not bathe in the same place as whites, and now she helps feed and clothe the poor in Poughkeepsie. Patrice also works to empower these people, helping them fight against their own oppression. In addition to thanking the governor for her award, Patrice made a passionate plea, asking Cuomo to help the community of Wappingers Falls.
So I'm making this plea in the name of justice, in the name of Dr. Martin Luther King. Governor, please do something. Do something. Now, what they're saying here, now, they'd say, Mrs. Patrice, it's outspoken. Yes, I am, because I believe in telling it like it is. What they are saying, that they, Mr. Abram is not totally representing them like they want. Now they say, well, there is no justice, there's no peace. And it seems like there is no justice in this case. And Governor, I'm asking, I'm pleading with you, please bring peace to our community.
Patrice was, of course, referring to the Tawana Brawley case. Responding to her plea, Cuomo said Attorney General Robert Abrams was proceeding as best he could without the help of the Brawley family.
It is regrettable that he does not have available to him the cooperation of the people who know best. The people who know best what happened are Tawana Brawley and her family. For whatever reasons, and I will respect their conscience and their sincerity, they have chosen not to tell the truth to the law enforcement officials. If that is because they think by holding back they will get a new and better special prosecutor by their lights, then they are mistaken, regrettably, tragically mistaken, because Bob Abrams will remain the special prosecutor because he was a good choice here as he was in Howard Beach, and there will be no other special prosecutor.
New York State Governor Mario Cuomo. The Martin Luther King Medal of Freedom is an annual award given to New York State residents who've distinguished themselves in the fight for civil and human rights. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brenda McMahon.
April 5th marked the one-year tragic anniversary when the Thruway Bridge, crossing the Schoharie Creek, came crashing down into the raging waters, killing 10 people. That tragic incident has prompted many changes to occur in both bridge safety inspection and maintenance. Paul Rosenthal reports.
The tragedy that killed 10 travelers jolted many people and raised several questions and concerns about the safety of the state's 20,000 bridges. Peter Slocum, spokesman for the New York State Health Department, also works with the department's Disaster Preparedness Commission, the government body that coordinated the events following that stormy Sunday. In the wake of the disaster, Slocum says the state has done a great deal to improve faulty and deteriorating bridges throughout New York.
Well, the investigations of the tragedy produced some pretty clear messages about the need to improve the overall assurance system for the safety of structures everywhere. And there are two bills before the legislature now which really address key points, including improved inspection programs and improved accountability for inspection programs around the state, to try to make the focal point of responsibility rest in one place at the State Transportation Department, so they would have a view of the validity and accuracy of inspections taking place everywhere in the state. Also, there's a real need, we felt, as a result of the investigations, for a sort of cradle-to-grave examination of the bridge structures to identify critical potential weak points which should be examined with special care at the points when inspections are conducted, so that a bridge inspector has in his or her hand a cookbook, if you will, that describes the key potential weak spots in the bridge's construction and design, so that when they go out and inspect, they can check those to make sure not being affected by any changes in the environment.
Slocum says Governor Cuomo and the state legislature are doing their part to improve safety across the state. Governor Cuomo has requested an increase in funding for that specific purpose, and Slocum believes the increase will be approved. He says the legislature has also proposed a bond issue that would raise money for highway and bridge safety. The Schoharie Creek Bridge, which collapsed, was maintained by the State Thruway Authority. Art Isabel, spokesman for the Thruway Authority, says in the wake of the disaster, many changes have occurred on the Thruway's 800 bridges.
As inspections go, all of the Thruway mainline bridges are now being inspected by outside consultants. The consulting teams are all headed by professional engineers. Last year at this time, some of the bridges were inspected by our own maintenance people. By transferring the responsibility to the outside consultants, we free up the maintenance people to do the maintenance on the bridges. Another thing that's happened since the bridge collapsed is that our underwater inspections, all the bridges that needed the underwater inspections have undergone an inspection of that type.
Isabel also says a hydrologist will be hired to examine the water flow underneath Thruway bridges to see what effects the flow has on each bridge. And what about the bridge that collapsed into the Schoharie Creek? How is the rebuilding of that structure coming along? Isabel says the Thruway bridge will be open to traffic within the upcoming months.
Works continued, some work at least was done during the winter, and it continues at this point. We hope to have the bridge opened, and as you know, right now it is open to traffic, but we hope to have the entire bridge completed by Memorial Day. The bridge is a stronger bridge, constructed in a wider channel. It's state-of-the-art construction. The top engineering and design firms in the country have worked on it.
Art Isabel of the New York State Thruway Authority. The bridge collapse was not without its controversy. An area farmer led an unsuccessful protest after the state placed a detour on his land. That farmer, Walter Dufel, took his protest to the state Supreme Court, which ruled against his legal challenge to the detour construction. The detour is now closed, but pavement still remains on Dufel's land. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
Soon there may be no smoking signs in public buildings and restaurants. That's if a bill proposed by the Senate Republicans is passed into law. Bruce Robertson reports on the legislative proposal introduced, which would ban smoking in public places.
State Senator John Dunn, Republican Deputy Majority Leader, proposed a smoking ban which would prohibit smoking in all public areas of state and local government offices. The bill would designate smoke-free areas in private companies and allow smoking on a restricted basis in school buildings, courthouses, arenas, waiting rooms, and banks. For the last decade, smoking restrictions have passed the state assembly but failed to move in the Senate. Critics have said this is because of intensive and expensive lobbying efforts by tobacco lobbies. But Dunn says there is another reason, that is, people are more aware of the dangers of smoking.
But I think generally today, there's a recognition that with the scientific evidence, which was not quite so clear a decade ago, demonstrating that secondhand smoke is injurious to the public's health, I think that the time has come to recognize that there's a generally broad consensus that we must have legislation. And I think that's probably why we have been able to have such broad bipartisan support for our proposal.
Assemblyman Richard Gottfried, chair of the Assembly Health Committee, says Senator Dunn's bill is a step forward, but if it passes, these restrictions will preempt more strict smoking bans that have already been established in several localities.
The Senate bill has a very odd provision prohibiting the health department from adopting any regulations implementing the bill. It also prohibits, the Senate bill prohibits local governments from enacting any stronger legislation to protect non-smokers, which is unusual in the public health field because quite commonly we permit stronger local legislation to protect public health. And I think once you acknowledge, as the Senate bill does, that that smoking is a very deadly form of air pollution for everyone, including those who don't smoke, then I think you want a fairly strong bill.
A few areas that have instituted stronger smoking bans are New York City and Nassau and Monroe counties. Dunn says the purpose of his bill is to treat smokers fairly and not as second-class citizens.
You start out with the assumption that secondhand smoke is injurious to health, but by the same token, you want to recognize the right of people to smoke, and if smokers can be accommodated without interfering with the general populace's right to have smoke-free environment, it should be worked out. And that's why we leave the flexibility to employers.
Last year, the New York State Public Health Council, an arm of the state health department, instituted smoking regulations that went beyond Dunn's proposal. But the state's highest court ruled that these restrictions were unconstitutional. Faith Schottenfeld, a spokeswoman for the health department, says the Dunn proposal is a good one for now. She says if other companies want stronger regulations, they can implement them on a case-by-case basis.
A lot of businesses and restaurants already have chosen, without any regulations or legislation in place, to have their own smoking policies. You know, it's something that has really come in time in public perception. And a lot of people already have given great thought to creating policies that do this. And it seems to me that with or without the involvement of the legislature or the health department, it's very possible that a lot of these areas that are currently not covered by any such regulation or legislation could incorporate their own smoking policies, as we see now in many, many businesses and restaurants.
Although there has been some criticism of the Republican proposal, Gottfried says the smoking ban is a positive step forward.
I think it's very encouraging that there is such good support in the Senate for the bill that they've proposed, which, while it has problems, goes a long way farther than anything the Senate has ever been willing to discuss before. So while I'm critical of many aspects of the Senate bill, I'm very encouraged that they've come this far, and I think there is definitely enough common ground between the Assembly and Governor position and the Senate's position that if everybody approaches this with an open mind and some goodwill, we ought to be able to negotiate something that can become law this year.
Assemblyman Richard Gottfried, the proposed legislation, if passed, would prohibit smoking in auditoriums, gymnasiums, classrooms, bowling alleys, and restaurants with more than 50 seats. Reporting for the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show was produced by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Paul Rosenthal, Bruce Robertson, and Inga Sarda. We hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in again next week to hear what's happening in and around the Empire State. Until then, I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the Legislative Gazette, a weekly newspaper on state politics, with student internships available.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.